Ray Anderson, and I'm going to be the moderator tonight. The topic is giving the music back to the people. And the panelists, in the order that they will be speaking, are April Larson, Norma Anderson, and Philip Brunel. And they are going to give their own biographical sketches because they know what they want you to hear rather than what I might think you want to hear. First, they're going to each give a 5-minute presentation. Following the 3 5-minute presentations, they will each give 2-minute presentations where they can argue with, amplify the speeches that have been given previously. So at this time, let's begin with April Larson.
I'm April Allring Larson, and I'm presently Bishop of La Crosse Area Synod. But I wanted to give you a little bit of my music background so you know how I ended up on this panel. After I went to Luther College, I sang in Rite Choir, finished up at the University of Iowa, sang with Dan Mole and took choral directing from Dan Mole there. Then I taught music for a couple years and taught choral directing, had some choirs and church choirs, and all the way through seminary directed some church choirs. Had a community, six to eight community choir that I worked with for a couple of years while I was a pastor in one of our calls. And so kind of kept my hand in mostly church music and some community music until I actually turned into one of those synod staff people about 5 years ago, and I've missed that. I also have done some national church song leading and choral directing. The first time was in 1984 at the National Women's Assembly in Detroit, Michigan. And I had about 300 or 400 women in a choir, and there were about 3,000 people there at the assembly. That was my very first time with a really large group, and I've done a number of districts and states. And then in 1993, I was a global mission song leader and choral director for all three of those in 1990. And the 20th anniversary of the ordination of women, I was a choral director and song leader. That's been kind of my experience with song leading the church. And I did a session last week on song leading in which I talked about giving the song back to the people. And a number of the people that were at that session said, let's have a forum on it. And that's kind of how this thing got started. So let me just say a few things about that. I think we're assuming, all three of us, that there will be in music good theology, that it will be basically Lutheran and confessionally Christian, and so we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about that. But one of my concerns, and I think that my concern is growing in the church, that I think more and more we live in a society in which music has become very professionalized to the point where we have developed in our church, much stronger than even when I was a child, a lot of hymn watchers, people who watch the hymn book, and some of them don't even watch it, and fewer and fewer people actually singing. There can be a lot of reasons for that, but I think one of the things that we need to do as people who are musicians or just simply as regular people in the congregation, expect from our musicians that we will serve the people's song, and that the music, which was one of the primary ideas of the Reformation, was that the music should belong to the people, that it should be the people's song, that should be happening in the church. And I think that doesn't mean we do poor music. It means that if we're doing new hymns, that we teach the hymns to the people. And that doesn't mean that they only get 60% of it. I think it's really important when you're song leading, if you happen to be in a setting where you're actually a song leader, that you are not singing into the mic so you can't hear if people are getting the music. And I think that goes with the same thing in a congregational setting. Teach a line. You can do that with an instrument or you can do that with voice. And then listen to see if people are getting it. And once in a while, maybe just have 5 rows sing it to make sure that they're getting it. And the other people can quietly listen and say, and those are the guinea pigs. And they can worry about whether you're going to call on them next. And but those are very simple ways to give the music back to people. I worry, it's crazy, I can't believe it, but in the last 10 years, just in Bible camping, how this has changed. Kids go to Bible camp, and we have three children that are pretty good musicians, and they come home and they know about 70% of each song. They can't really quite sing one song quite right. And I think that's because we're up there with our five or six instruments and we're making a lot of noise. Nobody can quite hear the melody. We don't know if people are getting it. And there's a lot of that going on in the church. And I think one of the other things that we don't do is we're not doing enough memory. We're completely tied to words and music before us. And I think we need to make some decisions. Certainly, and I think I've been very happy with music at Holman, so I want to say that first of all. But I think we need to do in these settings, in Bible camps and adult retreat centers, we should be making some decisions as perhaps a staff and say these 5 or 10 songs we are going to teach people this week. So when they go home, they know them and they don't need a piece of music in front of them that belongs, that song belongs, that hymn, whatever, belongs to them and becomes part of their faith, memory, and heritage, and something that they actually have and is part of their corporate experience, a faith experience in that community that they carry back. You know, when you sing that music, I sing music that I've learned in all kinds of settings, and I remember the community, the gift of that community. I don't just remember that song, but I remember the gift of that community, of that worship setting. And I don't know if that's 5 minutes. Am I pretty close?
You still got another minute.
I got another minute?
Yep.
Woo! I don't want to give it away here. Just see what I said here. Okay, I think that's one of the things I was thinking about tonight that I haven't thought about quite in that way as I was preparing for this. Listening to the people. Assisting the gathering in their song. And I think as musicians, we remember that it belongs to the community, the music. And finally, we could say it belongs to God, but it's our expression of worship and praise to God. And that is the people's song, and I as a musician assist. And I think many times, you know, when you're leading music, sometimes you just pause and you get those moments where the community just sings. And they're doing, it's like they're one voice, and they're connected. Maybe you've done some things to help that happen. Maybe you've done some things to help them listen to one another. Maybe you've done some things that lead them into hearing their corporate song and sing it together,
small.
But then you let go of it.
30 seconds more.
No, I'm okay. That's good. I'm done.
Okay. Norma next.
I'm Norma Saturn Anderson, and I'm here teaching an intergenerational music class, and we've had fun there tying, working together or not working, playing, singing, having fun with kids and with grandparents and with young adults and the whole gamut. And I've really enjoyed it a lot. I graduated from Augsburg College, grew up in a pastor's family with seven siblings, and we had music in our home from the time I was tiny. And we always loved music in our home and were part of church choirs wherever we went. And from the time I was in first grade, I said I wanted to be a music teacher. And that's what I did after I graduated from Augsburg College. I taught vocal music K through 12 for several years, before, or 2 years before we were married, and then for several years after that. And then after we were married, we had a son who had severe heart problems, and so I felt that I could not be teaching full time. So I did some substitute teaching, and then I was in church music work and have worked for quite a few years as director of music in churches. And now, and with adult choirs and children's choirs. And for the past 2 years, I've been doing exclusively children's choirs in our church. starting with children from 3 years old and on up through junior high school. I guess that's enough about me. I've done some song leading as well. Mine sounds like I'm talking to choir directors, and I hope I'm not too pedagogic or something, if there's such a word, after your exciting talk. But I'll just say what I had thought about. Give the music back to the people is the title of our forum. And one of the ways in which I feel the songs of the church are being lost is the fact that many of the people don't know the hymns and the music of the church, don't know it well, and therefore they can't sing it well. And so they're unsure and uncomfortable. And I feel that as those responsible for the music of the church, we have to keep in mind that many of the people in the congregations are not musicians, and some of them really aren't that interested in the music. So if they come to church and don't feel comfortable or secure, they're more or less threatened. And part of what our job is to help them so that they can participate enthusiastically and actively. I've sat in congregations where I've noticed people close their hymn books when there's been a new hymn or a new liturgy that they're unfamiliar with, and I think that's a shame. Choirs and organists must constantly remind themselves that they are servants of the people, like you said, and of the church, and that their role is to support and strengthen the congregational singing, and not only to perform anthems or other service music. And there are many ways that hymns can be introduced, and you talked about that, just by hearing the organist play a hymn as part of the prelude or the postlude, or by having the choir sing a stanza or two before the congregation joins in, or by repeating it for several Sundays. And eventually the congregation will feel, even some of those people that don't consider themselves musicians, will feel familiar with those hymns. And new liturgies can be a threat as well. But those too can be taught, and I think they should be taught in a specific way by a leader who, in a well-advertised and well-rehearsed or well-planned rehearsal with the congregation, and where they go over difficult parts and help people where they might be unsure. And sometimes a solo instrument, not drowning out the congregation, but leading them in the difficult sections. And then I think one of the things that I have been very much interested in the last couple of years is education with the young children. And I have found that that has meant so much in helping to bring the music back to these young people. I have heard people say through the years that the children aren't singing the hymns and the liturgies like they used to. And in my mind, education of the children is so important there. And there's one tool that has come out quite a few years ago through the ELCA, and it's published by Augsburg Fortress Press. It's called the Alleluia series, and it's excellent for teaching the liturgy and the hymns and all about the church to children. We use the Alleluia program with a 3 to 5 year old class. And we teach the children about using their voices, first of all, but about worship and about the church. And then there are hymnlets where we just teach them probably a line, a refrain, or a part of a hymn. And we also teach them parts of the liturgy, and we let them pretend that they're the pastor sometimes and respond. And these kids are so excited about that. And they come to church and they'll sing the hymns with gusto and those parts of the liturgy that they know. And I think here again, the familiarity with these things are what makes them comfortable and happy to be there. Then another way in using children's voices and children's choirs to introduce a new hymn, they can be used in that way. If they are taught the hymn in the first place, they can sing a stanza. or they can sing us an intermittent stanza between the congregation, or I've used them as the cantor in singing parts of the Psalms.
30 seconds.
Okay, I got to hurry on this one. One thing that we did last year that was a real success in engendering excitement in the kids about hymns, we had a hymn learning contest. And through my choir and then through the Sunday school. And the kids, we had a couple of parents who would listen to them if they said, I know a hymn. And they could sing one stanza or as many, get credit for each stanza. And then, I got to hurry, they parents became also became interested. Can I just do this a little bit? I'm almost done.
Can I resist?
He knows. So the conclusion of this was that there was a hymn festival, family hymn festival, at the end of this contest, and the kids got credit for every hymn that they knew, and then there were awards. The three top kids got each a Lutheran Book of Worship. And there was a lot of interest and excitement in that, and it was really fun. So I'll stop.
You're done. Okay, Phil?
I'm Philip Brunel, and I am not the organist in the Lutheran Church. And in fact, I've been up here since, first year was in 1964, and Carol Hinderby wanted me because he said, got to get some people that aren't Lutheran to come up there. And so over the years, as you can hear Carol saying it, so over the years I have come up and done music, but it's been 5 years since Carolyn and I have been back. I'm in Minneapolis, and for the last, well, I've had a church organ job since I was in ninth grade, and a covenant church first, and then another covenant church, then 4 years in a Lutheran church, and the last 24 years at Plymouth Congregational, downtown Minneapolis. When I arrived at Plymouth that first Sunday and played the hymns, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't hear any singing out there. And I remember saying, that will change. We also have, I've had over the years, just a big, big, big interest in hymns. And I'm sure one of the reasons why when Garrison started his radio show and I was involved at the beginning and have been in touch with him ever since is because Garrison and I have a very similar background, which comes from a very conservative denomination, but it was one that did a lot of camp meetings, hymns, and all of that kind of thing. So we sort of knew all of that kind of repertoire from going way back. I'd like to just say a few things about two areas. The first one, it has to do with just organists themselves. And it's something that I often share when I do a lot of summer teaching in workshops, and it doesn't matter to me whether I'm doing it with one denomination or another. It has to do with how organists approach hymns. And I think one of the things people need to realize is that in many cases, organists have come from training in various conservatories and universities, when I can tell you the teacher of the students is saying, oh, and you know, in addition to everything else, you have to play hymns. It is not said as if it is a great part of your training. It is something you have to bear. So I'm only saying it because that is part of where a lot of organists come from. They don't come from, you know, necessarily. There's some wonderful hymn playing organists, but there's a lot of awful ones. One of the reasons that hymns are not played well by organists is that organists do not, they shouldn't sing out loud, but organists must be following along with the words as they are singing. If you do that, two things are happening. First of all, I guarantee you, you'll find the right tempo. Most organists tend to think that allegro is the tempo for all hymns. You know, like, let's get through it fast. It's absolutely stupid. The fact of the matter is, there is a varying tempo for each hymn. And you can find it if you yourself are singing along. You also can see where the pauses come. But if you're not following along with the hymn, you know, you don't get the congregation the chance to breathe. Now, one of the biggest problems with congregational singing on Sunday mornings is that as opposed to earlier centuries, people today only sing on Sunday mornings. That's 99.99%. So therefore, they come, they're not warmed up, boom, hymn time. And they have to do it. This becomes a real concern, and it's something I'm always very, very aware of at Plymouth, with the fact that people are arriving and they suddenly are going to sing three hymns. And I mean, there's a number of things you can do to help them, but the fact of the matter is people don't come having sung during the week at all. It's not like the old days when in the 19th century there were this make music at home kind of situations. If you are concerned about hymn playing, then the registration that you use on the organ takes into account. Some hymns are bombastic and need to be that way. Some need to be much, much quieter. I am very, very pleased that at Plymouth Church we do not have the new Lutheran hymnal. I think it is absolutely appalling that the Lutheran hymnal has taken out part singing.
Yes.
I know that that's something that was a deliberate decision. I think it was an absolute incorrect one. It means that everybody must sing unison. And unison singing is wonderful. When you sing For All the Saints and you use Vaughan Williams' tune, you should sing the unison. He's written an organ part that goes, you know, goes around, and it's wonderful. But when you go to sing a hymn that it's something like, well, let's just say if you were going to do Dear Lord and Father of Mankind, or if you were going to do something, just one, you know, a quieter hymn, it's so wonderful to be able to sing Fairest Lord Jesus. It'd be so wonderful to be able to sing it in parts. You can't do it anymore. Not in the Lutheran hymn, though, you can't. But at Plymouth, we still can. And I can tell you that almost, well, I can't think of a Sunday in the last year when I don't drop out and let people sing a cappella. We do it all the time. It's just simply a fact that everybody does it. And as soon as people sing a cappella, boy, do they start gathering in, and they have a voice in what's going on with the singing. But you see, you can't do it if you don't have the right, if you don't have the harmony in the hymn book for people to be able to find. The thing that ends up happening with hymns in church is also that you need to find ways that you can challenge the congregation to be able to sing. There are the ways that have been mentioned here. There's a number of other things. You can do little pre-service rehearsals that can happen before the service has begun to say, hey, we've got this new hymn that's coming up. I pick the hymns at Plymouth. I think that the church musician, if the musician is concerned about hymns, should be doing that in consultation with the preaching minister, always. And I've always said to the ministers, hey, I'll show you what the hymns are, and if you want to change them, you know, you are the final judge. In 24 years at Plymouth Church, they have been changed twice. Part of it is that, you see, I'm the one who's keeping a record. When did we last sing this hymn? I can't expect the ministers to be sitting there saying, oh my, you know, we just sang that 3 weeks ago. You know, I mean, they don't do that. I mean, my predecessor didn't do it, and the minister was choosing the same hymns every Sunday. You know, because, I mean, he's like, oh, did we just sing that one? Oh, I don't realize that. You know, so you need to keep that. And my normal pattern is to have two hymns that I believe the general congregation knows, and one that's new.
30 seconds.
And so with that happening, they end up being able to work on a number of hymns. We do a hymn of the month from time to time. There's a lot of other kinds of things you can do with hymns, but some of those I will demonstrate at Saturday night's Vespers. So.
Okay, you've heard the first round, and let's go into the second round. 2 minutes each for rebuttal, arguing, confirmation, whatever.
Do we sound like we disagree?
I think we set that up just in case we really, you know, felt a need to do that. But I'm really delighted with what was said. I don't feel like I need to add anything.
Do any of you have anything you care to add?
I do.
She was hardly done, you know. Yeah. She had more.
Here I thought I was going to have enough to say. One thing that you mentioned, April, about memory, and I think recently in teaching, a lot of teaching in the church, confirmation and everything, the kids there are not required to memorize things like they did in the past. And thinking in terms of memory of scripture and memory of hymns, I'm sure I'll see people nodding their heads when I say, if you have an elderly parent, or if you had an elderly parent that knew scripture, that knew the hymns, when that person becomes very old, many of the other things are lost, but those things that are memorized are a part of their life even to the very end. And those hymns are very precious to them. And I think it's a shame if we lose that, and if our generation and the children, the young people, lose that, don't have that. Then one more thing I think that I feel, when kids go to camp, or in, also in Sunday school, I think it's great that they sing some of these lively, peppy songs, but I think there should be some music there, some hymns, some of the songs that are sung on Sunday morning, so that they can sing something, they don't come back with something that doesn't have any carryover value at all.
Okay. Bill, anything further?
Just a couple things. I agree very much that children need to know what I'm going to call some of the basic hymns. And so in consultation with the youth ministry at Plymouth, we make sure that the kids have learned in their church chapel services. There's some Sundays that they're not in the regular worship, they have their own, and they learn these hymns. But then I always make sure that when they are in church, they sing the ones that they sang in chapel so that they get to sing them with the grown-ups.
Right.
And they feel like they're all a part of it all together. I think in our day and age, one of the saddest things that is happening in many, many areas, and it's certainly happening in music, is that we are now saying that everything we do, it's best if we just, if we always cater to the lowest common denominator, because that's simply the only way that everybody can do something. I think it's absolutely a bunch of baloney. I think that people can be encouraged and challenged and taught to do better than they think they can, and that the lowest common denominator simply leads in everything, whether it's hymns, music, or anything, to a level of music that is just appalling. And it just simply isn't a part of Plymouth, and it's not going to be. I can only do what I do at Plymouth, but I know, and I have encouraged a lot of other people in music, and I know that it has happened. I remember that one year we did, with the children, Benjamin Britten's Neues Flud, that wonderful children's opera, had 80 kids from the church and the neighborhood as the animals in the ark. And they have to sing several hymns, and they're in very florid language of Kettle from 300 years ago. And one verse I remember that they had to memorize is, "What though in solemn silence all move round the great terrestrial ball? What though no real voice nor sound amidst their radiant orbs be found?" I was told by parents it's impossible for them to learn. I said, "You're absolutely wrong. Watch this." Got the kids all together and said, "Hey, we got a verse to learn, and you're going to hear some words that almost sound foreign. But watch this." And we start, I said, "Terrestrial ball." I said, "We start talking about the world, and the world is round." And I said, "What's another word for round?" "Ball." "Good, you got it." Now I said, "You all heard the word terra firma?" "Yeah." I said, "Well, that's where terrestrial comes from." We talked all about that. And of course, I said, "Go home to your parents and say terrestrial ball." And I said, "They'll just be knocked over." These kids were so proud that they could say terrestrial ball. They sang the whole hymn by memory. They had no questions about it. Not at all. But I refused to say, "Oh, they can't do it. We must play down to them." They don't have to be played down to it at all. And the kids, because of it, did what they needed. My last little comment was, the first year I was at Plymouth, I also do, when we do a hymn that has a number of verses, I always do an improv before the last verse, mainly because I find that since people can't sing, there is a point at which they simply have to clear their throat and cough. And that's why at the end of every verse, I hold the chord for an extra whole measure. I hear organists that go pop and stop and go right on. No one's even had a chance to take a breath, you know? And I always hold the chord. Everybody goes, So before the last verse, I play this little thing. And I sometimes do an introduction. This woman came up to me in the first year I was there, and she says, "Mr. Grinnell, what is that stuff that we're hearing before the hymn begins and sometimes in the middle?" And I said, "Oh, those are called improvisations." And so I did this whole thing, and I thought I'd make this nice thing. And I said, "And it goes all the way back to Johann Sebastian Bach." And she looked at me and she said, "Bach wasn't a member of Plymouth Church." And walked away.
April, Ava changed her mind.
It's still stimulating listening to these other two.
She has something more to say.
Just wanted to support what has been said and encourage people again to, whenever you hear that people aren't getting something, to actually work on that section. It seems like the silliest of all things to say, but I have watched even very outstanding, well-known musicians sung under them. And every time we do the music, we always start at the beginning. And so we slop through that same section we've always slopped through, still don't know it, and keep relearning how poorly we don't know it. And so I really encourage you, whenever you have an opportunity to lead music or help people with music or encourage somebody who is leading music, to work on those two measures or those three measures that people aren't getting. I think that's critical to having people own the music, that it becomes part of them. And I also want to say I really appreciate and very thankful that for the day that we live in the sense that there are so many finely trained musicians in our churches, and I'm not in any way implying, and I know Phil wasn't thinking I was, that I'm not looking for the lowest common denominator. I'm looking for the very best music we can have in our churches of all kinds, international, global, two-thirds world, contemporary, Bach, Handel, the whole nine yards. I'm all for it. And I think we can get that to people. Most of us who have become, in the sense of professional people in the church, whether pastors or directors of music or choir directors or whatever we've done in the church, Christian education people, if you start pulling these people, most of these people have gotten excited about the church through either music or some Bible camp experience. And I think the best youth ministry we've got going in our churches has been music. And maybe we ought to be taking another look at that. Maybe that ought to be what we're doing with our high school kids on Sunday morning, because they're not coming to Sunday school, that's for sure. Maybe there ought to be a youth choir then. I don't know. But I think music is something that we kind of have been losing, and it really is one of the best ways for us to get people excited about their faith and continuing the church.
Okay, now it's your turn. Ask questions. You can ask questions of individuals or just direct it to the panel for anybody to answer. But I'd like to request that if you're sitting in the front here, you may think we can all hear it, but the people in back might not be able to. So when you ask your question, speak loudly. We want to hear both the question and the answer.
I have a question for any one of you. What is your thought about junior high and high school kids this day, and can we still have choirs for that age group? Because the churches that I have been involved with, they're too busy and they won't come, and so it's always rot. But, and yet I know, I've heard the stories of, Sunday school choirs when we had hundreds of kids. What do you think?
I think one of the things we've found at Plymouth, it's a huge problem. It has always been a huge problem when the voices change. There's no question about that. And one of the things that we have done, because we have a wonderful program for the young children starting at age 3, it's really a problem for downtown churches to have choir programs for kids, because it's totally dependent on parents bringing them. It's not neighborhood time where they can walk to a church. It's like, oh dear, and to try to get parents to understand that it only works when they come every week, that they can't just sort of show up once a month. But we've gotten that part. But the junior high and senior high, what we've found right now, it's been difficult for us to have a choir work. So instead, what we've done is twice a year, the junior and senior high put on a musical. And we have them working. Some are working in sets. Some are working in, they're not all performing. Some of them don't want to perform. But we have had, one of the people in the church, Janice Hardy, has just written a phenomenal musical that was all about people. She wrote it when she was walking her dog around Lake Calhoun, and all of a sudden her dog got away, and the dog was over. Then she went to get it and found out that it was with another dog, and those people were definitely folk that were sort of at the bottom rung of society, and she, in order to get the dog, she was talking to these people. So it's this whole thing had to deal with the young people understanding and dealing with very, very poor people in our community. And the whole musical was about that. And it was just wonderful. And so she's going to write two more. And so that's the way we've been getting at it.
We have a youth choir at our church, and I don't direct that. And it has been good. I think it depends upon the director.
It's like big churches, though, right?
Yeah.
You're talking big churches. Yeah. You're talking this choir, that choir, that choir. Yeah. What do you do in a small church?
Well, it seems like they usually go into the adult choir, which isn't easy. I was going to say there is
more. Do you want to clarify small church for this group?
Sorry, can you, a couple hundred members maybe?
A couple hundred worshiping or a couple hundred total in the church?
Probably 150 worshiping or 25 worshiping, small number of kids. I mean, we're talking a youth group with 10 or 12 kids in high school.
That's tough.
It's tough because when there is a small number of kids, they don't want to be isolated. It's the old strength in numbers business.
Right.
And suddenly they become soloists, and unwittingly.
Well, actually,
you know,
that's what we've done. We have kids we have an excellent band program in our town, and so a lot of the kids are in band, so we'll get the kids in with the band instruments to be involved that way. But
well,
the choral side is,
I have seen two small rural churches of about that size, 100, 150 worshiping people on Sunday morning, have outstanding music programs. One of them is in our synod right now. One of them is a church that Judd and I served. And I'll tell you how their music worked. First of all, it's a congregational event, but they don't have really very many rehearsals. There might be a little rehearsing during Sunday school, but they're rural people, and they don't really like driving, right during church times to take kids to music. It's actually more difficult, I think, in those churches. But what I saw in both of those churches that I have not seen anyplace else, and that is when they get up to sing, and it varies, but usually it's everybody. It's all from little to big, or maybe it's the first a little and then they add, or maybe it's the big kids. But when they get up to sing, all of the teachers sing with the kids. And I'm not talking about this ridiculous, stupid thing, excuse me for anybody I'm insulting here, down on the pew, Molly and Worse the kids. Hang that stuff. The ones that are working are standing right up. You're a kid, got it? They're standing right up here.
I've known it all along.
They're standing right up here with these kids and singing. And it's working because nobody, and the high school kids, are up there singing. I've seen this in two churches. It works. And the high school kids are singing. There's 5-year-olds and 10-year-olds, and they're right up there singing. Why? Because all of these adults that they respect are standing, men and women, standing right up there with them, singing with them. And not mouthing and not saying, well, this is the kids' song, so we sure don't want to be. But everybody is singing with them. And that is, I think, one of the ways to do really effective small church music.
Another question?
You've talked a lot about hymns. What about, and people's music, what about liturgy and what about songs?
Well, I talked about, you mean, singing, the fact that people don't sing it well?
Yeah.
Well, I think, there again, I think if people are familiar with it and know it, they'll sing better than if they're unfamiliar with it. And that's, I think I talked about teaching it to, if you go into a new liturgy, but I think maybe periodically, even if you're using the same liturgy with your church, having a session where you just talk, I think a lot of people don't realize what the whole liturgy means. And if that can be explained, and then explain how it should be sung, and work on that, just have a session on that, and I think it does make a difference.
And just a quick response to that, too. I think when you're teaching a new liturgy, rather than give a congregation the whole wad, just give them a little section,
a little bit.
One Sunday, maybe another Sunday, that section plus a new section, and then maybe over a course of a quarter, they finally then do that whole liturgy, rather than just...
I'm in a big church in Beaverton, Oregon, and we have a couple problems. One is We have this brand new church that is acoustically dead. And one of you talked about people not even opening their hymnals. Well, we've gotten into the thing where everything's printed in the bulletin, so there's no reason for anybody to open a hymnal. And I'm really concerned about that distracting people and not encouraging them to sing along or try to read the music.
You mean the notes aren't there?
No, it's just the words are printed in the bulletin, so that you never even have to open your hymnal.
Have they gotten permission on all those words?
Yeah, right.
I was just trying to find an angle for you there.
The copyright laws.
You know, if you have a church that's acoustically dead, I mean, it's such a sad situation, because the fact is that people, it's one of the hardest things I know, because we went through this at Plymouth, when we put the new organ in, and we, you see, the old church, well, the church has been there since 1908, but at some point, way back when, in the 20s, some plaster fell off the ceiling, so one week in between that week and the next, they went and put beaver board over the entire ceiling. Beaver board is the most absorbent thing you can do. It's what you have in your rec rooms and in your basements when you want to have everything, all the sound soaked up. And so, you know, I remember coming to Plymouth, what is all of this? You couldn't see it. I just knew that for this building, somehow, it shouldn't be this dead. And of course, part of the problem of getting people to sing was that, you know, in order to sing, you need to be able, something has to come back at you. It doesn't have to come back a lot, but you kind of have to feel like, I can hear other people, I can hear something going. Explaining acoustics to people is virtually impossible. I mean, it's not something that they can grasp onto in ways that will make them understand why they have to give some money to make it work. And so what we ended up at Plymouth, we did fix it. One of the other things that happened is that there was a man back in the 50s who just, you know, loved to donate carpet. And so, of course, everything was carpeted. And I had gotten rid of some, but I hadn't gotten rid of it all. And, of course, what they found when we pulled up the carpet is, of course, that in 1908 they put parquet flooring all over. Mm-hmm. And they went, you mean this has been underneath all of that? And we went, yep, so let's get that carpet up, which we did. And, of course, what ended up happening is people were just shocked when they all of a sudden heard. And it isn't a huge reverb. I mean, it's maybe a second and a half, so it's nothing huge. But the fact is, it's enough that people now kind of can hear a little bit of what it is, and it does make a difference.
It really does.
It makes a huge difference. It's something that I couldn't do, though, until I had been at that church long enough that I was trusted. I couldn't go in there the first year and say, the acoustics stink, rip out the carpet. No way. They would have said, see you later, Grinnell. You know, but after I'd been there a while, and then I began to say, you know, I think there's some things we should do, and one of them we should fix is the acoustics, and we did. As far as your point about hymns, all you can try to encourage is to say that, and you see, to me, the hymn book is like, the hymn book is in, it is the musician's Bible. And everyone is a musician when they're in church. They're all singers. So if they can't have their musical Bible, they can't participate in alto, tenor, bass parts. And in many cases, people don't even know the melodies. And at least, I mean, whether people say, I don't even know how to read music, it's people, by just the process of following along, can learn to read music. Because music is not something that you were born with, and otherwise you can't do it. And as I said at the choir tonight, sight reading music is something you simply get better at by doing it. There's no other way.
Okay, can I jump in on that one? Because you called on me earlier,
yeah.
So now I'm going to claim my...
Okay.
I think that there's a point here where churches are really struggling. I have two little bits about this. One is this hospitality issue and making being welcoming and being accessible and all these issues. I mean, it's one. Is it one or is it the other? Are we friendly? I mean, I love the hymn book. It is like a companion and like another almost a hymn Bible, but I see churches struggling with this welcoming thing, and then you've got a lot of people coming into a congregation. And my own congregation, I left in Minneapolis, many people coming in who are not from liturgical backgrounds. I have to set one thing down and pick up something else because that's too hard. Now another part about that, our congregation had a... So that's the dilemma. Our congregation had a catastrophe a couple of years ago when there was a decision made to do a contemporary service, it was abysmal. Because they had, and the pastors in Corpsman Seminary aren't trained in contemporary music, they knew nothing about it. And we had a sequence of the most inane, awful, quasi-contemporary, theologically unsound, just catastrophic music. And these services went on, ground on, for an entire season before they finally died an awful death. But it was, you know, how can churches accomplish this kind of contempt thing that they want to do for people who aren't liturgical and do it right? That's what I mean.
And if we don't give the right response, are you weeping down balcony?
I've never fallen yet.
Let me just say that I think that on one hand, a church, whatever it brings to it from its background, a church has to be faithful to what it is, and it can't change with the winds as things, you know, has changed. It's you can't suddenly say, oh, we should try to get all of the folk that might be in the let's say in the Hmong community, even though there are none going there at this moment. So let's make sure that all of our services are also translated into Hmong. Or we see now out of this. And also, let's make sure that we don't have anyone that's hard of hearing going to the church, but let's sign language all the services. In these things in which you suddenly are trying to be a lot of things to everyone, and suddenly, part of the reason for the diffusion is that you're not anything. And I think that for new people coming into the church, I think that there should be offered on a regular basis. If I was in a Lutheran's situation, I would want to see that there was offered on a regular basis for new people coming in a chance separate from the service to understand how the liturgy works and how you sing it. And to say, you know, these are part of the things that have been going on for centuries that are part of what we believe is important in worship. Worship is drama. It always has been. And the fact is, therefore, you need to make sure that people, you know, do that. But there are ways to do it outside of the service without suddenly saying, oh, we have to get rid of this because so-and-so doesn't know about it.
Okay.
I have a question about the way music is printed. It seems to me that we have lots and lots of presses now that are publishing music that are really very difficult to read, not only for the congregation, but for the choir. And I'll be very specific. I think that, for instance, Marty Haugen's service of Now the Feast and Celebration is one of the worst pieces of printed music that I've ever seen. And yet we've done that. My congregation likes the service. They're getting used to it. But when you try to read the leader part, and you've got that booklet, and even when it's been supposedly improved by putting in the hymnal supplement, it's almost impossible to read. You can't see. You have to turn the pages, and then you have to go shuffle back for the repeats. And if they don't know what a repeat looks like, or if the accompaniment doesn't include the cantor's part, I mean, it just makes it very difficult. And so I'm thinking, I mean, I'm very frustrated with that, because I'd like to have them know several liturgies, and they're doing very well. But I don't know what to, I mean, does a letter to a publishing company?
To a publisher, oh, believe me, publishers will automatically respond when you do that. Because oftentimes, the problem is oftentimes the editors who are putting the music together. I do music for one of the big publishers, and I can tell you that we have one, but in many places the editor is not someone who is actively involved in using the music. So the kind of thing that you're talking about would never even ring a bell with them, that they would want to do it. And in addition to it, sometimes the constraints of how many pages they want to use,
right,
are what account for a lot of the repeats, even if they don't necessarily make the repeats make sense. And there's ways that they could do that.
In addition to that, I mean, not only is the music difficult to read, but if you're a presider, you've got to have three pages open at once if you want to get the Eucharistic prayer and some of the responses there, I think. Yeah, it's a wonder people just don't give up.
It's almost like people lay awake nights and try to figure out how to make it difficult.
Yeah.
Well, I think they're it's an economic thing, I think.
I think it is too. Oh, I know, but I mean, it is, so it is. I know it's an economic thing, and I think it's...
Believe me. And you know what? And when you write, this is like writing to politicians. The thing that politicians will most respond to is a handwritten envelope, a handwritten note, because they are now so used to getting things that are all computer-driven, and they know that those are all just sent, you know, ad libitum. But if it's handwritten, you will...
Let's go to another question back here. Go ahead.
My point came from Anne's question before, because I would like, there's a campaign I've always wanted to start, and it sounds like a good time to start it, to abolish the use of the adjectives contemporary and alternative with worship and liturgy. If we do the Latin Mass, but it's 1993, it's contemporary. You know, whatever that congregation chooses to do for worship is contemporary. And to talk about any congregation having a worship time that's alternative to its other worship time, I mean, what does that say to the people that are about the people and how they're attached to the community that are going to the alternative one? Are they alternative to the body of Christ? I don't think so. And it just, and it also just weakens the potential of trying to do anything lively in the midst of the congregation that really comes from that community.
The word contemporary is a real misnomer, because there are many different kinds of contemporary. If you go to hear a symphony concert and they're going to play a contemporary piece, it's not what you're talking about something for a church liturgy. I mean, we don't have that at Plymouth, what you're talking about. I mean, when I think of what I know, when I hear the word Christian contemporary, I don't ever use that word. I just call it Hollywood music. Because that's what it sounds like to me.
Well, what I'm talking about, so it makes sense. You don't know about Lutherans, is that if somebody goes to, if they decide to do Marty Haugen, for example, not to be in celebration, they will say, we are now going to start a contemporary liturgy. Contemporary meaning the composer is either still living or the thing was written after 1962.
That's right.
That's what we mean, and that's what I'm saying. Let's get away from
that. It's a certain style. Yeah. It's a certain style of writing, though.
No, it's anything except the standard liturgy, usually.
And I'd like to respond to this also, just to simply say that I think my preference in worship is that we would mix things up. I think that we have a very diverse group of people that are worshiping together, and we are the body of Christ together. And some of those people that walk into our church have never been, hopefully, in a Lutheran church, and maybe not even in church before. Hopefully, we have those people coming in. And so then we have to be thinking constantly of them. And then we have people, hopefully, of some other different backgrounds as far as just ethnic backgrounds. Maybe from the two-thirds world, and they're now part of the United States. Maybe we have people from different church backgrounds, have no liturgical background. Maybe they're Baptists, or were Baptists. I mean, we have all kinds of people coming in there. And so I think we need to be true to our heritage and share that gift with the church. I'm not in any way saying sell off, but I think we can, to me, some of the most exciting music is, sometimes I feel like we're discovering a taste of heaven as we listen to some of the music from all over the world. I think that's one of the most exciting dimensions of the church right now. To me, even more exciting than some of the work that some of our folk writers, might be a better term, are doing.
Let me just add something to that. Just that the challenge, it's interesting at a place like Plymouth, I mean, we are a congregational church. I think it is now something like 9 or 10% of the people who come to Plymouth were ever congregational from roots up, from their birth. Most of the people that come to Plymouth Church are former Lutherans and Methodists and Presbyterians and Catholics. And we've got a few of everything, but that's what we most are. So we've got this big melting pot of people. And so it's wild to think of how, when we put these hymns together, what we're dealing with. I mean, it's a real challenge. It's a wonderful challenge. I love it. But it is a real, you know, so we don't have that, the challenge you have, but we have a different one to deal with.
But you could put a little handle together with
South
African freedom
music. Another
question
right
back
here.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the basic four-part hymn and all this kind of put together.
I think I was just going to say, I think, and I hope that that's what is happening. I think I see that happening in the church, this melting pot, that paradigms of alternative versus traditional worship, and high church versus low church, and all those kinds of things are disappearing as we go into the next century. I hope so. And in that point, and also addressing her thing, I think in the Lutheran Church, one of the faults that we have had, perhaps, with this tension between hospitality and holding on to some integrity to our tradition of music, is that we too often, because our church is shrinking and we're losing people, we tend to make music and liturgy the whipping boy, kind of. It's a very convenient scapegoat when really it's a sort of a symptomatic thing of much larger issues. And I wonder if we maybe don't need to look more carefully at other models, other ways the churches are dealing with, like in the Catholic Church, the rite of Christian initiation for adults, where there are models whereby newcomers and ritually illiterate people and people who have never had a life in the church are brought up in the faith and are taught these things and grow into that. And Roman Catholic Church supposedly is one of the largest growing churches that exists. And also what I see happening there, at least in parishes where they have a budget and they can hire musicians who are trained, is that they are discovering that, you know, 20 years ago they threw the baby out with the bathwater with regard to music, and they're recovering a wonderful sense of an eclectic blending of old and new and what they had at one point and what they've developed since, and Protestant traditions as well. And so
reactions to what he said?
The big basilica in Minneapolis needed a new hymnal, so they looked around at what the Catholics offered and said, no. So they took the Episcopal hymnal and said, no, this is closer to what we want to be able to do.
Closer.
Two more questions.
Laughing when you said you had the Lutherans over there. We go to the Episcopal Church, we're Episcopalians, and we got the Lutherans too. I used to be a Lutheran, but our choir director is David Dahl, and he's a very fine organist and choir director, and of course, we go there because the music is wonderful. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are other Episcopal churches a lot closer to our house, but...
One more question.
a comment. I think that we are in a kind of post-denominational time and wonder what that does mean for the worship. Mm-hmm. I have a colleague who says ritual does not paper-like.
Ritual does not
paper.
That's exactly right. Oh, that's right.
And I often observe in our congregation and elsewhere that people are just fumbling with the bulletin and with the hymnal, and so they take no cognizance of one another. There's no concentration of the body as a body. And I'm just wondering what we do about that fact. I mean, worship is most effective when we all see one another, when we're all participating in the drama, because now we're not looking at the printed page. It doesn't have to be using the same setting of the liturgy all the time. But it does, somehow or another, we have to work with that fact that we're not constantly tied to a text that gets between us and the rest of the members.
That's why communion sometimes is the most beautiful part of the service, because in some churches there is some free, led by the musician maybe, that the music begins and it's music that people know.
Mm-hmm. In our congregation, sometimes they chant, and they go on and on and on. You've been going all through the communion.
Or call and response.
And everyone can catch, didn't have to know a note of it before they came, because it's repeated.
Absolutely. It's very, very effective.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say, I think that's why if people really can be well-versed in the liturgy or in these other things, when they know the liturgy, they don't have to use their paper or their book, and then they can really feel it much more. But of course, changes.
But yet, at the same time that you have that part that draws them together as something they know, there have to also be those parts of the service in which they can grow, so that they are not simply, I mean, I know from when we grew up, we sang every Sunday morning, opened with Holy, 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 every Sunday. And so, you know, that meant basically that if there were three hymns in the service, one position was to be thrown away because it was the same hymn all the time. And you suddenly, we're down to two as a chance for people to explore the wealth of wonderful music of any century that was there. And so I think the worship service has to be that always unique and always working at a situation in which parts of it are things that people come together because they know them well and they can participate in them without perhaps having to read at them. And then there are going to have to be other things in which they need to be stimulated much in the same way that you wouldn't want to hear the minister every Sunday preach from the same passage of scripture. And so I think it has to have both to be vital.
I think we better bring it to a close. It's 10:05. Thanks to the panel members. Thanks to all of you. If you want to continue it, you can continue it on an informal basis.